This is the Made of Clay report, Facing Our Lives, with Peaches Gillette and Hugh McAlier. So, or Hugo, as we're going to call him, unless you prefer to be referred to otherwise.
Hugo's.
So the topic today, the topic for this episode of Facing Our Lives is change. Change in your life, change in our lives. Most people have a negative relationship with change. We will dive into change that has been damaging and change that was a saving grace. Similarly, how has unwelcome change proved to be a gift? How has welcomed change proved a challenge or worse? And why for either? So that's just some of the direction we're going to head over the next 2 hours. And we have lots of music to share about change. And we'll figure that out as we go along.
I love the topic, and it came up because it's the monthly topic at the Universalist Unitarians Church. And I happened to be doing the sermon this month, and so had to write about change. So it was really interesting to think about it, and also interesting that I made it a point to kind of talk to or do brief interviews with several people, just saying, what do you feel about change? And all of the feedback was negative, which I can't say I was surprised at, but I was sorry about that. No one had another perspective on change and looked at it actually as if they are a victim of the concept of change, which was very interesting to me. And so I decided to take it in a completely different direction, because there is the direction to take it in. I didn't have to create it. Whereas change is much more dynamic than people express it to be.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're just attached to something specific and can't give it up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hugo, do you want to say a little bit about why you chose to step up to this topic of change today? And then we'll begin to go more deeply into what Peach's experience was, and maybe I'll, some of my thoughts on change too. Yep.
Well, change is, at my age, inevitable, and you can like it or not, that you're not going to escape the creaking bones and the ligaments that are complaining. So it's not a matter of the ignoring it, because the body cannot ignore it at 78, going on 78 years old. So, but if you step back a few years, a major change for me was the decision that had to be made to leap from the family farm in Florida to Ithaca.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a forced change in some ways, because of a family dispute about whether or not to hold on or to let go. And so when I see my sister, I thank her for being the catalyst to blow the whistle on the fact that I didn't want to be sitting on a farm by myself at 85 years old. And so it was a leap, a great leap, from there to here. And what I really appreciate now on the hindsight is the necessity to begin that downsizing in life, not just of personal goods, but also your expectations, your diminishing future. Your time is running shorter, and you don't know how long you're going to be here. And so that's a change that you can either ignore and go to the gym and try to build up more muscle tissue that's going to diminish no matter what you do, or you can pick something appropriate for your age. And I think that that's an element that I have found in whether or not it's can be termed acceptance, in a way, it can be termed acceptance without surrender, because you don't surrender what you're still capable of in staying vital, you know, on all levels.
Mm-hmm.
So change to me is both. It's a paradox. It's both negative because of the physical aspect, and it's positive because of what it allows you to shift into another gear. It can be slightly slower gear, but it also, in my own life, I'm trying to fill what I'm losing by gaining spiritually what I feel is still growing.
Yeah.
So that would be my initial offering for my perception of change.
Right. Okay. I want to just offer a very small story and then amble back to Peaches. The small story is over the weekend, I was talking with my son, and we're going to all have Thanksgiving dinner at my daughter, his sister's place, and they have a 3-month-old baby now, and we're going to go down and spend a few days with them. In the past, my job was to make Thanksgiving dinner, and over the years, I would make as many of the traditional family dishes from my family and the farm in North Missouri that we'd been making for, you know, 50 to 120 years in one form or another. And this year, I might make one or two things. I might make homemade noodles. I might make rolls. But that whole meal, which was a feast, a very high calorie feast, is not going to happen. And my sadness was evident to my son, who wanted to fix it by saying, why don't you just go ahead and make the things you want to make? And I said, no, my sadness is my sadness. These are things that don't mean as much to you as they did to me. And I'm letting them go. So let me be sad, and I'll enjoy the meal that we're going to have. But this is not, you know, this is, don't, my sadness is existential. It's not, it's just, I have to get on with life. I need to just recognize this. It's part of my becoming an old man whose children don't want what I wanted. And someday I'll fix that feast again, but, or maybe not. But I'm not attached to it so much. And as we segue back to Peaches bringing up this topic, when King Solomon was purported to ask for what is the piece of wisdom that I need to have, you know, for my being a ruler, and what came back to him was this: this too shall pass.
Mm-hmm.
This too, whether it's wonder and joy or horror and depravity or utter lostness, this too shall pass.
It's interesting to me that it kind of swings back to the concept and the observation that I've made about how it's very difficult for people to hold two different concepts in the same space. That it either has to be bad or it has to be good. And as opposed to and looking at themselves as being victims of change, as opposed to actually being part of change. And they don't, because we have this victim mentality society and culture, what they don't realize is that what the adverse reaction to change is all about how we respond to it more than anything.
Right.
For the most part, it's just about how we respond to it. And we can respond to it by not looking at it as being something that has attacked us or taken us down or ruined our lives, as some people do, and not giving more weight to positive change any more than you give it to negative change. Change is indifferent to us. It is not out there to get us, you know? And so all we're left with is how we respond to change and being able to hold the things that make you sad that you lose, because part of change is loss, of course, and to hold that in the same space and just say, this is what I'm experiencing, as opposed to that darn change, I can't believe that did that to me.
Right.
You know? And so I find that very interesting. And I also, the thought came to mind that in a spiritual world or in a spiritual frame of thinking, like, we understand that our bodies will no longer be this, right? And they will transition or transform into something else, maybe energy, maybe in spirit. Well, if you look at change as just a similar process of transforming and transmuting and changing into another form, like a memory becomes the form of the change. And I do like the word acceptance. I use it all the time. Then I think we would be less plagued by what we see as negative in change. Mm-hmm. Change can be painful. We're not going to deny that. Nobody wants to lose a husband or lose. That's true. But that doesn't make change bad or terrible.
Right.
It actually just points to the nature of our humanness.
Right.
That's it.
Because I'm in the midst of being a grandfather to a relatively newborn child. That child last weekend learned to roll over.
I love it.
Which means that child can no longer be tightly swaddled.
Yeah.
Because if they roll over and lay on their face, they could suffocate themselves and not get out. But because this child learned very quickly how to sleep through the night, because they figured out how to read the cues and get her down when she was just getting sleepy and not until she got fussy. And then it gets hard to get them to sleep. They got it really quickly. It was beautiful watching this, but they will never have a swaddled baby again.
Mm-mm.
And she's got to learn how now to sleep when she can throw her arms and legs around. And that's going to be another round of not sleeping. But our whole life is these changes, going from infancy to toddler to child to older child to teen to pre-adult to adult to whatever and to dying. And we on some level welcome those changes, but we also don't really engage them.
Mm-mm.
And to not fear them means you have to engage them.
Mm-hmm.
And grieve what you miss, let it become a memory, to try to anticipate what you want to embrace. And if you can't do it, find something else.
Mm-hmm.
But and there's no victimhood in growing up.
Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting to me, because this morning I got it thinking, like, is there some sort of like hedonistic practice going on that, if it doesn't change in a way that makes me feel really good, then it's bad. Like, you know, it's very strange to think like that. Whereas change often, and even, you know, even when I was writing about it for the sermon and talking about the beauty that change can allow, the beauty in our bodies changing in order to even carry a baby, to make a baby, all of that takes all this change that goes on. Not only internal change, but external change and emotional change and all those other things. And it's the funniest thing is, like, the same people that I kind of interviewed about change were the same people would be like, oh my God, don't you love the change of the seasons? And I'd be like, okay, use that. That's a good one. And let's expand from there. I'm sure there are other things that might be great when they change. When your body is sick and moves into healing, that change is fantastic.
Yep.
You know? And I'll take it an extreme step further by saying, when your body is sick, and sometimes it changes your perspective into a better perspective about life and the people you love, there's a beauty that can be found in that as well.
Right. I want to go back to what you said at the very beginning of this last comment. And there's a sense that if you don't like it, it's bad. And we have so thoroughly become a consumer economy and a spectator of our lives. And we watch TV, we watch movies, we listen to music. If we don't like it, it's not good. And we've kind of gotten caught in this consumer trap.
Mm-hmm.
And when you when you believe that you are a partner in making your own life, when your body takes you out because it can't process what you're doing, that's a gift of your body to you as often as not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
And we don't recognize it that way.
No.
And you go almost all of your story was grounded in the body and your bodily changes.
Mm-hmm.
In your sessions, I mean, people experience the beginning of profound bodily change in their 70s in a way that for most people doesn't happen until their late 70s, and then 80s, and then 90s is a whole different experience of life. But you're a musician, Yuga, and you've had many kinds of work to support your musical habit, but you're a musician. How is this physical change changing who you are?
Well, profoundly, because my thumbs are beginning to be bone on bone, and so I can't stretch on the keyboard as far as I used to be able to. So, yeah, it's always present with me now when I get up in the morning that this is inevitable,
mm-hmm.
you know, that there's nothing that they can do to address peripheral neuropathy, for instance. It's just there. It will be there. And the bones of my thumbs have made an awful lot of music in my lifetime. And for that, I'm really grateful. But I also realize that will change, you know? But it also reminds me that another biblical reference to everything, there is a season. And for me, I like to consider myself in the late fall, transitioning into early winter. And it gives me a beautiful seasonal perspective of where I am in my mortal life. And it's not frightening. There's more gratitude now on hindsight than there was when I was going through very difficult life changes. But it's nice to be at an age where you can look back and you can see how much change was a positive movement, you know?
You know, I even addressed the idea that, you know, referencing all these movements for equality that changed the way we treat people and changed the way that gave room for people to do much more, all came out of change. Mm-hmm. That we actually fought for. Most of us actually fought for. And I think that what puzzles me is how people forget that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what puzzles me, because it's right in front of our eyes. I mean, really. I mean, even from moving from the inability to accept something to the mental and emotional ability to accept it is all based on change. And so, and I think of it like, and I think of when I think down the line of things I want to talk about or write, and I think that we need to find a way to add more detail to everything that we feel so that we really are examining it in a much more profound way. And I think that we become very superficial about our language and about how we explain things or how we even perceive, look at things. And if we did a good study and a good exam about any subject, like change or anything else, we'd be like, oh yes, I can see why that helped make a difference. I can see why that, you know, that process was meaningful.
Right.
I can see what how I grew from that. Go ahead, Eric. Right.
I want to come back to this topic, but I want to take a musical break. What should we play musically at this time? Any ideas, or shall I just pick?
What is that song? Hugo reminded me of it when he took that quote from Darwin. Is it by the Birds?
For Everything There. Yeah.
Yes. I love that song.
Yes, it's Ecclesiastes.
Exactly. I love that song. Yes.
We'll play
I thought
that
they
now.
Originally wrote that. No,
when you were a kid. Yeah. Actually, when I was a kid and I didn't know the Bible, that's exactly what I thought. Exactly. I said, wow, that's really neat. There was some change in front of the way for me for that one.
That's right.
Peaches, you made the observation that we need to be more detailed about our understanding of our experience. When you said that, it made me think about certain smells, certain words, certain movements tend to provoke in us a whole set of memories. And we have a very hard time taking those apart. And oftentimes they are very positive. And so we want to go back to them. Or they were very hard and we don't want to ever have them be intruding again. And so I think one of the things that's really, really hard is to be in a relationship where the environment hits us with this information that is so either positive or negative, and we can kind of get lost in being kind of engaged or triggered is a negative word, but the positive things are triggered that in that overwhelming way too. And more in the form of nostalgia. I was talking with a person, I had this experience on Monday, but I shared it with someone who had was having the same experience yesterday. And I was overwhelmed by an incredibly negative and judgmental time in my life, so much so that I had to lay down and take a nap. And my dream life just went wacky for that 45 minutes to an hour. I wasn't sure I was asleep or not because so much stuff was processing. And then this other person I talked to had the same kind of experience where they're in a really productive time in their life in a new city, in a new place. But the whole day they were overwhelmed by something that had happened 6 years ago, 8 years ago. And it was just dogging them, haunting them. And they were trying to, they were trying not to succumb to it, but, and they had enough wisdom that they didn't try to push it away, but they hadn't yet accepted the fact that they needed to just walk with it. So when you talk about being more detailed, I see how that works in terms of being more detailed about in the moment, but so many of the things that make us experience changes, remember changes being horrifying or just sweet, or not wanting to change because things were so sweet, they're rooted in a past that really dogs us for good or ill.
And we all have that same experience. I think that for me, it's first of all, you can practice acceptance even before the thing happens. That's just a human reality. That's partially what meditation is about and all that stuff that we can do. But for me, I think that the question at the end of every experience that flares certain emotions for me is, okay, what can I do with that emotion so that I don't, so that it doesn't become like quicksand. And I think that part of what I'm pushing, and I know that this is like contrary to American psychology or European psychology, whatever, is that we have enormous power over our own minds. And we do not push that at all. And so everything that comes into us emotionally, is we're supposed to respond to it. That's just the reality. It's there. It's part of us. It's some of it is part of what made us who we are right now. So that's not the solution, is to try to pretend it didn't happen or try to push it out of your head. That's not the solution. So for me, the solution to not being drawn into a lingering darkness, because you can be drawn into momentary darkness, or which is perfectly fine, because you can find things in that, right? But to not be drawn into such a lingering darkness that you now reject the world, that you now can't see happiness in anything, that and that happens to people. So the question for me at the end of enduring all of these feelings is, what wisdom can I garner from there? Because I'm telling you that I can get wisdom out of any experience I have. And that's where my head goes constantly.
Right. And you secure the wisdom from the experience.
Yes.
And you said this isn't American or Western in its roots. I had a seminary professor who, if he could have done anything in his life, it would have been to resurrect the word piety.
Yes.
Because what piety meant was to be in sufficient management of your faculties that you would catch these things that would come at you and you would work with them and not let them run you. And that's what true piety meant. That was a common understanding of a certain kind of mature Christian faith in the 1600s. But by the 1700s, kind of enlightenment and willfulness and stuff had kind of taken over in a way that dominates European and American culture. So that we don't have that kind of Buddhist non-attachment mm-hmm. that was meant by true piety.
Yeah.
That's very interesting, Eric. I never heard that definition, but it's being able to grab it, whatever the it is, before it grabs you. And that means that you can experience the emotional side of a circumstance, but there's also a part of you like Beaches, you speak of the power of the mind. The power of the mind allows you to observe yourself having that experience as well as having the experience. So it becomes less personal, but not objective. It's both. We hate paradox. We hate to feel something and observe it at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a very difficult kind of spiritual discipline to be able to stop it for a moment and breathe and name it mm-hmm. before it grabs you and say, ah, there it is. Let me breathe into this now. And that way you're not repressing it. You're not pushing it away.
And we don't do those things alone. We do those things, right? Because we learn from other people. We learn from wiser people. We learn from prophets. We don't do those things alone. But when you're in a culture that has a psychology that teaches you almost the exact opposite.
A culture of isolation.
Isolation, yeah. A culture of like being, you know, I love the idea of diving really deeply into whatever I'm feeling. I just love that.
Right.
But I'm diving in there for a reason other than being stuck.
Right.
And we don't give people any ways or language or tools or practice on how to not get stuck, even if they dive into it. Because some emotions feel like they just dragged you down. Like you had no control. They just like grabbed your feet and pulled you under the surface. Well, when you think about how they train like Navy SEALs, they're already ready for that. We could train ourselves to be ready for that tug under the surface and develop mental and emotional skills to how to wiggle free and get back to the surface.
Right, right.
Before we drown, right?
Right, 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 right. Because hypervigilance isn't a way to manage it. You can't avoid it. But if you can once you've noticed that you've been hijacked and you're asking, you're asking yourself, where am I and what is this handbasket?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's neat.
You know, I may be crazy, but I just, you know, we have these great brains, right? That look at around us, look at what we've done with these amazing brains. And you can't convince me that we can't use the same amazing qualities of that brain to work ourselves back into a way of looking at things in a wiser, more beneficial, more effective way as a community and as human beings interacting together. You couldn't convince me of that. You know, we just have to it's like building somebody's esteem, right? It's like building the human self-esteem and saying, you know what, you are magnificent. I've seen you do amazing things. I've seen you go through things that most people wouldn't even bear if they had to go through things. I know you can use that mind to do better than you're doing. Not only better than you're doing, but to get where you actually want to be.
Right.
I didn't tell you that. You told me where you wanted to be.
And with my friend yesterday, I had to say, you will be haunted.
Yes.
By these things that will drag you. And just keep putting one foot in front of the other.
Yes.
Because when you continue to do that, you will discover that you have probably done reasonably well or okay. And even if you didn't, you're still walking. And
hey,
even
okay,
if you, even if you got, but even if you got completely sidelined,
yes,
you can say that that happened.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm going to move on from that.
Yes. Yes.
I had an epiphany.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Hugo.
You know, Eric speaks of these wild dreams. I have a dream that's very relevant to what we're talking about. Very simply, I was standing on the shore and a tsunami came in, grabbed me, and was sucking me out in a riptide. And as I was going under, I was saying, I'm going to have to use only one molecule of oxygen at a time. And in the dream, I could feel myself only really preserving the little bit of oxygen that I had. And it actually pushed me gently back onto the shore.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a symbol of letting it go out into the riptide, but knowing that you've got those resources to withstand not being drowned, you know?
And if you understand that,
you
can go even deeper in the emotion.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
You're not afraid of not being able to come back from it.
Right.
And you can get a lot of great work done going deeply. Like I like, Eric, when you were saying that how you were going through a lot of emotional stuff to the point that you had to go to sleep and you had all these dreams, just that to me is fantastic. Like, first of all, sleep is amazing. It's like, it's a healing thing. And your brain, when you dream, is like going through all this stuff and working out all this stuff and showing you all this stuff. And it's such a powerful way. I use dreams so often to resolve things. And once they're on my mind, because I have a hairline trigger to dreaming, once something's on my mind, it's coming up in the dream. I'm already waiting for it.
Right.
And in that dream, I already know, okay, I'm going to find answers there. And I do. And I love the idea of like just sleeping and dreaming, you know, where your mind is not pressured. You're not, your mind is not pressured by you going, oh, I have to live up to this, not to conform to this. I have this appointment. When you sleep, you're just in your sleep.
Yeah, but you're surrendering part of yourself so the other part of yourself can say something to you.
Exactly.
Right. And the surrender language is the tension with willfulness. But if you can just stop, and it's not a matter of surrender or not surrender, it's just a stopping. And for me, for better or worse, I've had this capacity to sit in conversation with people and then they'll ask me, where'd you go? Because on my face, I disappeared for I don't know how long, but I can just go into another space with a sense. And if I trust that and I don't try to fight it, if I just trust that, I often end up seeing or understanding something that that I couldn't have put together. And if I'd have tried to stay engaged with the people around me in that moment, I wouldn't discover it. But it's hard in a world where you're expected to be attentive to just disappear.
Yeah. And you can, like for me, and sometimes, I don't know if everybody does or can, but like for me, driving, that's why I love being on road trips, is that exact place. Driving to me is like being in a dream where I can work out amazing things and look at things in almost a surreal way, and where you're seeing nuances that you don't see when you're holding everything into this structure that we're supposed to see it in. And dreams are beautifully unstructured. And so other little things sneak in there in the door that you can see that you don't necessarily see when you're awake.
Let's cut to music. What should we play next?
I know Hugo has great songs about change. Someone mentioned was there a Beatles song about change?
One of the ones that I picked up was the Imagine song by John Lennon.
Fantastic. Perfect song.
Sure. This is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives. Peaches Gillette, co-host, Eric Clay, co-host, and our guest today is Hugo McElyea. We are considering change, kind of just meditating on what it means. Peaches, you brought up the idea of change and justice and how they're linked. And I'm going to introduce a topic or a set of topics that people that I know have struggled with. I am not entirely a moral relativist, but I understand a lot of things are more complicated than I can understand or necessarily live with. And I know people make decisions, and I'm here to be useful. And for example, helping people make decisions to birth or to abort. That's a huge decision for some. It's not for others. Having people decide whether or how to be supportive of their person who perceives that they are in a body that's gendered in a way that they can't accept. And they want to change that identification and maybe even change that physical reality. I want to hold up the idea that another person's dreams might be as important as my own, but they don't have the resources. And I have more resources than I need. or maybe I don't have the resources and they have more resources. So how do we engage in this process of envisioning change when it challenges us to support people or to take action that we might be uncomfortable with?
In reality, we don't have to do that. If I'm completely uncomfortable with something,
mm-hmm.
and don't support it, let's say,
mm-hmm.
I can embrace the person and not support the concepts or the ideas. I'm not a hindrance to change.
Right.
Change is going to happen. I can't stop that. None of us can stop that. So when we link those two things together with change, because I don't necessarily believe or support it or whatever it is, I'm not a hindrance to change. And so they don't intersect in that way.
Right.
Right. But what you can do often, there are times when you could actually physically help people go through whatever they want to change, right? Like if they want to change, like the abortion thing and things like that,
right.
you could drive somebody, you could help people do that.
I've helped people make decisions in both directions on that. Lack of support of others whatever. It's just part of being a human being.
That's exactly right. And also just on the side, sometimes the idea that we are just there can ignite change in that person and in ourselves for that matter. In other words, sometimes when you're sitting with somebody and they're bouncing ideas off you, when we bounce ideas off other people, we're also thinking about what we're actually saying again. Mm-hmm. We're thinking about it again. Is this in our minds? We're saying, okay, is that really how I wanted to say that? Is that what I really feel now? So we examine our thoughts even when they're bouncing on somebody else. And sometimes that can make us change. Sometimes you'll say like, you know, as I'm talking to you, I realize that that's not what I'm really invested in.
Right.
After I hear myself saying this, or that's what I'm really invested in now that I kind of affirmed it just by having somebody to speak to.
Right. So, and when they see the reaction or the impact that the words had on the other person, it may not have been the response that they anticipated.
That's right.
They understand they're playing with an idea that's not what they thought it was.
That's right. And then they might go, okay, I need to go to somebody else.
Yep.
So they change their direction.
Right.
On how to resolve these things. So follow up what you said again, either state it again, because I want to add more to it. I want to hear what you said again.
I'm not invested in what I said, which is kind of an interesting thing. I was trying to get at, and this is what I'm trying to get at.
Okay.
When we are responsible for engaging the world around us and finding a way that we can live in it, we choose,
mm-hmm.
and as much as we can, that's our personal agency.
That's right.
So in order to do that, we have to cope with changing bodies, changing minds, changing resources, changing seasons, mm-hmm. houses that work or don't work for us mm-hmm. At a particular time. So what I wanted to ask you is how did you learn this approach to change? And what I want you go to think about too, or to speak to is, how did you become a person with the kind of agency that you could make your life an experiment? Or that you could try and see what worked
on
to the next thing. I mean, and you go, you were sitting on a farm in Florida, and at 75 years old of age, you didn't have to move 1,000 miles north. You could move someplace else in Florida. I mean, those are those sorts of things.
Right.
But what I'm trying to get at is, what's the personal agency? How did you come to discover it so that the changes that you are living are the ones you are making choices about?
Yeah. In hindsight, I think I was risk averse for most of my life. You know, even though I was out there, and it wasn't until, as you said, the mid-70s that I began to be more fearless with change, because I knew there were unknown results of leaping off, you know. But I think the older you get and the more you realize how much time is passing, that you become less risk averse. You know, you open yourself up, you know, and you don't have to protect yourself. You don't have to protect who you are, you know. And I think moving to Ithaca was a major step for me, having been in the dark, deep South, where you do protect yourself, you do wear the mask, you don't overstep the bounds, because you're surrounded by an awful lot of negative judgment. And I think that it was an act of self-liberation to let go of that life and to plop down in a new place at a late time in life and see what happens, you know. But I had a soft landing in Ithaca because of why I originally came, you know, with the piece that was being done. That was the catalyst. But I was going back to the farm and just sit there, you know, and then the change came through my sisters saying it's time, you know. So it wasn't me making that choice by myself. It was actually a conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the conflict, and you mentioned that in your first opening statements, how much change has been brought about through a conflict or a negative circumstance. And I can use that experience I had of leaving the farm because of a conflict that I had with my sister. So that's an example of how, if you're stuck, and as Peaches, you say, someone can throw something at you that can immediately change your perspective, you know?
Right.
And I think that's what happened to me.
And so you're leaving Florida didn't surprise me, but your statement about coming here and not feeling judged, that surprised me, partly because I think a lot of people do feel judged here, either by virtue of the lack of educational attainment or the lack of economic of affluence in their backgrounds, or being a person of color or a person of a cultural difference. I think there is a lot of experiencing judgment here.
My circumstance was unique. Yeah. Everyone's circumstance is unique, and mine was just a softer landing because I wasn't a member of the community. And so I hadn't been in the community long enough to be pulled into a judgment, or negative or positive. So.
Right. And the farm you grew up on and the place where you learned to wear a mask as a child for your humanity is the place that you actually left.
Yes.
That's powerful.
Yeah. In fact, having lived 40 years in New York City and going back to the farm for 13 years, I realized that was the reason I went back, is so I could leave.
Right.
You know, it's really interesting that growing up during the time, the era I grew up in, growing up in a neighborhood that was very racist, and always being the outsider. Well, I don't remember the song, but the words that Bob Dylan uses is, if you ain't got nothing, you've got nothing to lose.
Yep.
Often when you're an outsider, what happens is you don't get pulled in to the conformities that don't work for you because you're not allowed to be a part of it. Being part of conformities is almost like a membership for people because it helps build communities, whether they're negative or positive. You build groups around you. And once you build a group around you, what happens is rules start coming out that you feel like I have to honor or adhere to because I'm now part of this group and they accepted me into this group. And it's almost like a covenant. Well, when you're not allowed to be a part of anything, there's a certain freedom in that, right? It's a strange thing. Well, it's one of those dichotomies. You're rejected, but there's a certain freedom in being rejected. And so I was never pulled into this world where I had to restrict the way I thought about the capacity of my own agency, how my mind works. So being alone was probably one of the most formative ways that I became this way, because I had all the time in the world to think about and to also stand. You know, when you stand as an outsider and are observing, and you're observing what's going on around you, you learn a lot more than if you're in the midst of it, a lot more. And that's been the story of most of my life, you know, and it is up here to some degree. You know, when you talk about, Eric talks about the judgment, and I see it, but what it looks like to me is like, I'm actually watching like a gladiator event where people like fighting each other about who's more important and who recycles better. And I mean, just absolutely anything up here. That people like, oh, did you, was your chicken free range or was it free range? Something's wrong with you. That's what I mean the other day about politics interrupting everything now. You know, you can't sit at the dinner table without somebody asking you what kind of frying pan you brought. So I'm watching this thing and I'm thinking, wow, these people are kind of nuts. They start off kind of nuts and they can end up very nuts. And I thought, and I don't feel like I'm part of it, nor do I want to be part of it. So in some ways, there is a loneliness about it. There's the other side of that.
Right.
But there's
right.
also an amazing freedom about it that allows me to just be who I am and decide who I'm going to be because I'm not pulled into anything that I need to conform to. And part of that was I had the room to develop this. And that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is my mother was like this and, you know, things like that because my mother lived a similar life, right?
Right.
Rejection and finding some sort of freedom in that rejection.
Right. And what you're describing, also the song you referred to was Like a Rolling Stone.
Yeah, thank you. Yes.
And we will play that here in a moment. Right. But what you have done is that as you decide what your stance is with respect to the people who are competing for status and presence around you, then you become engaged in a kind of change that's not just personal, but it doesn't enter their fray. And how do you be with people who are stuck in this conflict that doesn't ever involve change? It only involves status. It only involves shifting status. How do you engage them without getting sucked into their status mm-hmm. fights?
And there's a loveliness to not being stuck because they can't hold me accountable because I never committed to them.
Right.
Right. Right. So they can't say, wait, you were one of us and you said you were going to do this. And I didn't do that. So right. So I'm kind of lucky that
and,
way.
And maybe later we can talk about what it's like to be a change agent when you're a traitor to your own kind. That's an important skill. But what you're talking about is when you are an outsider in the presence of bad behavior.
Yeah, exactly. I think there are a couple of things. One of the things is that I have this, I believe in people. I believe in their capacity to do better. I really do. And sometimes I think that if you can help them or join in with them in chiseling down the wall that they put up. I saw that happen at UU with people who were like, you know, like up here when I first met them, and they wanted
what,
to
what
know
does
them.
Up here mean?
Like they were above me. They, you know, they were affiliated with things that like I probably, they, I mean, they don't know me, but they assumed that I right. couldn't touch and things like that. They were superior.
Right.
That's it. In every sense of the word.
And it wasn't just superior to you. I imagine it was superior to the common ilk.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. Even though race always plays a factor.
Right. Right.
Once
right.
you're superior, race.
No,
will
no,
play
no. Back. Right. Right. Absolutely. Right? It's the.
And I've seen those same people. Because my whole mission in life is to open my heart. And I mean, when I say open my heart, I mean to expose myself. Right. I don't mean just like, oh, I love you, come in, to expose myself, because often people, it's like the bystander effect. They're waiting for somebody else to expose themselves or to be quote unquote vulnerable, which is the word they use, so that they could feel like, oh, well, maybe I don't have to be so afraid of being vulnerable or so afraid of not saying that hurt me or that made me feel afraid. And so often I use that as a technique. I do it in my prison work. And it often, 90% of the time, will make people open themselves up. Right. Once your hearts are open, you could do a million things with that. That and I've always found that. And so I've seen people soften themselves and talk to me differently and engage in real emotions, you know, and I love that.
So let me just try to get a better picture of what that looks like. So as you are witnessing two people argue about an appropriate response to a racist incident, and they are white people, mm-hmm. You are going to step in and say, I don't think this is about a right answer.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is about something about relationship. Same way it would be if they're arguing over how we should recycle or how we should manage the place. It's not about the policy. It's not about the technique. It's about the relationship.
Yeah. And let's get to that. Because we can, if we can get to that, we can resolve so many things, even race. If we can get down to like, what is it that we fear in one another or learn to hate about one another? That's really just an illusion because you don't know me.
Right. Right. And the common line is that those Trumpers or those conservatives are just rabid, hateful racists. Mm-hmm. And we're not.
I know.
And what that does is that it creates this illusion that you don't have barriers to relationship.
Right. Right.
How do
and
you
and I'm like and like and of course we all yeah. know there are people out there who just like they couldn't care less about, you know, they'll kill you no matter what.
But the projection that allows us to be smug.
Yes.
And a little self-satisfied and feeling like, well, we've done our work.
Yes, 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 yes.
Rather than, well, you know, show me your friends.
Yeah.
Show me who has dinner at your table.
Yeah. And I think I wrote that story about the guy with the gun in Montana. The story, I wrote it on Facebook. I'm going to show it, but I'll tell you now briefly. Mm-hmm. I walked into one of these makeshift roadside places with Tommy, who's white. And Tommy goes in, he's looking around, and the guy's looking at me like he doesn't want me in the store. Like, I mean, just like looking at me with that hateful look that I, trust me, I know well.
Right, right, right.
And he has a gun in a holster on his hip. And so I'm trying to ask him if he has certain things, and he's completely ignoring me. And a song comes on the radio, a country song that I happen to know well. And I said, my God, that's such a great song, isn't it? And all of a sudden his demeanor changed. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, it is. He didn't smile. And I said, is that the radio? I can't believe you have that on the radio. He goes, no, it's my personal, what they call these, I don't know, Spotify or something. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's great. And he smiled. You see how simple it was sometimes to just touch people if you're not afraid. Because I could have just left and said, I'm sitting in the car.
Yeah, I'm not going to put up with that.
Exactly.
I'm just going to walk out of here.
When I wrote the story, people were like, you shouldn't have done that. And I'm like, no, like that to me is like a little bit of an open door, a challenge for me to go, I'm going to try to touch this person's heart. I don't care who he is. That's what I'm going to try to do. And it was just fortunate that that music came on that we had in common.
Right.
He and I had that in common. We both loved that song and it made a difference.
Right. If you walk out in disgust, you dehumanize him.
That's exactly right. And I got nowhere.
And you felt dehumanized, but you were going to test that to see if you could cut through it when that music came on. Now, if that music hadn't come on, you might not have had that window. You might have had a different window.
Absolutely.
Or you might not have had any, in which case you might have gone out to the car.
That's right.
But because you couldn't find a way to be human.
Yeah. And I was like, I'm just going to try to find that window, because most of the time, unless somebody is completely committed to hate, most of the time you can find something. Even if you said, even if I just started a conversation and said, you know, I have this 5-year-old nephew. He's just a crazy kid. And somebody might go, yeah, I have one of those too. Very simple. And then you can jump off from that sometimes.
Yeah.
I love doing it.
Yeah. And it's not a Rolling Stone. It's an intentional.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yes,
we're gonna play that song right now, and we're gonna cut we're gonna cut the music, and we're gonna play that song because we've been rolling around a little bit here. and then we're gonna come back.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. We'll be right back. clowns when they all did tricks for you. Never understood that it ain't no good. You shouldn't let other people get your kicks for you. You used to ride on a chrome horse with your diplomat, who carried on his shoulder a Siamese cat. Ain't it hard when you discover that he really wasn't.
I'd like to spend, do we need to say more about what we just talked about? Is there more, Hugo, did you want to step in? Because I have a possible change of topic, but where do we need to go next?
One thing I know about Peaches, it's almost as if the circumstances of her early life were the foundation of her agency. She had to become her own agent. I did the opposite. I didn't feel I had my own agency, so I put what I call my tap shoes on and tap danced my way as a protective shield. And it was only much later in my life that I feel that my agency is authentic. So that's basically the difference, because I also came from a very racist culture, but I was on the other side of racism, you know? It's just so powerful, and it's music to my ears to be able to combine these contrapuntal lives that come together on a common understanding of how. And just one more thing, I may have told this, there was an actress, a very famous actress on Broadway, who once said, and talking about Peaches being open-hearted and transparent, she walks on the stage and she says, "If you strip for the audience will strip for you."
Yes, very good.
That says it all.
Very good, yes.
You know, because most of the hatred is based on fear. And you took away the fear of that man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting to watch somebody, it's interesting to me on a sociological level, to watch somebody who has committed themselves to hate, right?
Right.
And they feel like, so what happens is when you commit yourself to anything, it becomes part of your identity, right? And nobody wants your identity shattered or lost or anything like that. But to watch somebody all of a sudden drop a small measure of that commitment is an incredible thing to see.
Right.
You know, and it makes me think, if the circumstances were just right, that person might be able to change.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not something I could do alone, but you see the potential.
Right. But it's, if you don't look for those very slight opportunities, you're not gonna find them.
No.
And I was once hitchhiking back home from college, and I guess I had a ride to Des Moines, and I had to hitchhike down about 120 miles to get to near where I was from. And I walked off of the interstate into this little town, and somebody had seen me coming in with my army greatcoat and my orange backpack, and they had unscrewed the mouthpiece from the payphone, so I couldn't call anybody.
Wow.
And they wouldn't let me use a phone in the store in this little town, this little one store town. And all of a sudden, and I walked back to the phone to see if I could figure out how to fix it. And I couldn't find the mouthpiece and I couldn't fix it. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me, you know, I have a second cousin who lives not too far from here, and he's a well-known auctioneer. So I walked into the store and I said, "Do you know Lauren Clay?" And said, "How do you know?" Well, he's my cousin.
Exactly.
And all of a sudden I had access to a phone.
Isn't that amazing? It's amazing.
Yeah. But it takes a little, not pushing your way through, but dancing your way through.
Oh yeah.
And this is putting the dancing shoes on in a good way.
That's exactly,
because not all dancing is hiding behind a mask. It's
okay.
It's dancing with the people that you're actually with.
Yeah.
It's also amazing what a simple smile will do.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have a bag of tricks that I take with me everywhere. Yeah.
Right. And the bag of tricks exists, my guess, because you have learned a few things that worked, and they've worked more than once. So you've actually have them as tools.
Now, that's the way it goes.
So do you want, before we go on to the next topic, do you want to say a little bit about what's in that bag of tricks, or is it just something that will come out as we're talking?
Well, I'll say this one thing, that part of it takes knowing human nature. Part of it takes that, because if I didn't know that to the degree that I do,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't know what trick to use.
Right.
So when you find, and I know that people, even in regular conversation, we love affinity.
Right.
We love going, "Oh my God, I went to that school. Oh my God." Like, you know, like, "Oh, I have nieces that age too." We love that. It's part of who we are. It's a part of how we identify with another person and how they affirm our identity. And so I know that much. And some more, but that is really the foundation of, like, and so therefore, if I know that, then I know how to touch your heart. Right. Now, some people's hearts are very hard. So you can't always, you can try it, but some people it doesn't work for. But I've had it work enough that I'm keeping it as a tool.
Right. You know what right. I see? You know what I see?
Yeah.
I see two dogs in Central Park. They're either wagging their tails or they're growling at each other.
Yes.
You know, we're about that primitive, really.
Right. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
And I guess I'm what goes around my head, because it came up when there's a person who died this week who's been in shared journeys for several years, and she came to group on Monday night, and she died on Wednesday night. But on Monday night, she wanted to talk about something she'd heard on on the radio, NPR, I think, about the strength of weak ties. And it's a concept. It's kind of an important one. And it's what the organization that I work for is all about. And, you know, when your best buddies or when your blood relations, your understandings of each other get usually kind of rigid. Mm-hmm. They may be really deep, but they're usually kind of rigid, stuck in some ways. When you don't know somebody, they're a complete stranger, that's often rigid too, because they're stuck in that space. But the strength of weak ties are knowing people a little bit, because then you can introduce and make connections and be useful to each other in ways that you wouldn't necessarily be useful. So you know new human nature, Peaches, so you can reach into that other person and talk about the music and have a sudden connection. It's a weak tie, but it's a tie. And then if he needed something that you had access to, you could offer it to him, and that would not be best buddies, but that would be, oh, he needs her. That's the last person in the world he would think of needing, but he needs her. And so it's, and Peaches, you're muted. I don't know if you want to be muted or not. you're never muted, but
I love that.
What your bag of tricks is building on that idea of weak ties, just a simple little something small to connect with.
Because that's all we need in a moment.
Yep.
I only needed it for one moment
to
break the tension in that store and to give him another picture. You see, I represented something that he didn't think I would represent. Why in the world would a Black woman love country music or know it? Right. So I took down some concepts, and it only took 3 minutes to do that. And that's valuable, certainly in that situation.
Yep. You know. So Hugo, were you going to say something? I didn't know you. Okay.
No, that was good.
What I'm wondering about is sometimes we scare people by who we are, or who we think we are, or who we're trying to be. And I remember that moment in college when I went home and was having this kind of epiphany that I'm not so heavily gendered one way or the other, that I may be in some sense a bisexual person, or at least I'm comfortable with affection between men. And it took me some time to figure out that I'm comfortable in the way that most traditional cultures are. But I'm not in that sense bi. But it scared the dickens out of my my mother and my stepfather, who was like, "Do you know what kind of a life you are, you know, about to be thrown into? The way this and all the things that are going to happen to you and all of this stuff." And in a certain sense, I was a traitor.
Yes.
To their hopes for me.
Yes.
Wow.
Because I had gotten out of this rural small town poverty to go to college at Cornell.
Absolutely.
And they thought I had that I was just headed out in a really good way, and they could trust that, and they didn't have to worry about me. But all of a sudden, nope, future's not looking good for this one.
Yeah.
It didn't look good for other reasons, but that's a whole different story. but how is it? And we actually, those conversations led to a discussion about my stepfather, who had actually been a musician on gambling boats on the Mississippi River during Prohibition.
Amazing.
He played the saxophone until his front teeth got kicked out, and then he played the piano. And he had friends who were gay.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw the brutality that they suffered when anybody had any desire to humiliate them. They were just open season. And his concern was both fear for me and sadness over his genuine friends, what they had suffered, that he could not intervene and stop it.
That's right. That's right.
So what I'm trying to tell here is a story where when we want to be a traitor to our own kind, it's kind of important to be kind.
Mm-hmm.
to what is behind their hopes that are so, that's so hurt. And that's part of what makes change really hard for people to imagine.
Yes.
And I don't know if I'm, is this a useful space to open up? Am I opening up a useful space?
No, I would add on behind their hopes, but also behind their fears of what they're not familiar with, what is frightening to them, you know.
Or what they saw that they don't know could be any different.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which isn't a vague fear, it's an experienced reality.
Anyone who, like in the store that Peaches was in, the gentleman wearing the gun, there's got to be a fear element in that she disarmed, because it was of the moment that she was able to grab and find through the circumstances that disarmed his fear.
Right. And in all likelihood, he wasn't wearing the gun for an older Black woman.
Right.
That wasn't the person he had in mind when he put on the gun.
No, not at all.
But it's a symbol, though, of his sense of defending himself.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And it's also in one of those areas where there was a lot, I don't want to say a lot of tension, that's almost mild, where there was an enormous amount of hate against the Native Americans.
Right.
Enormous.
God.
Enormous. It was an ugly corner of South Dakota.
So it was the maintenance of power by hate.
Oh, it was unbelievable.
Right.
I'm sure that because of that whole setup, that he experienced some terrible things, right? Because people, when you hate people, you told them that they're allowed to hate you. That's what you just did. And so I'm sure that he's probably dealt with some things, and that's aside from all the things he learned, right? About like what Black people are and what Native Americans are and how they're this and that. I'm sure he had a whole repertoire of stuff that he had learned. I think that part of what happens, part of the fear, I think happened because who you are, just like you're the son of your father,
mm-hmm.
I was the daughter of my mother, whatever, we're all children of our parents, that part of their identity gets wrapped around you, is structured around who you are, how they raised you to be. Part of their identity becomes that. They can say, oh, I have right. this son who's going to get married and have grandkids for me, or I have this person who's going to go to college and blah, blah. And that's their part of their identity. Mm-hmm. And so you threaten a little part of their identity. And that is a very tricky thing for anybody mm-hmm. to feel.
Right, right, right. This past, I want to call out somebody who handled an encounter in a really beautiful way. This past September, I was visiting the farmland where I grew up. The house, the barn, everything's been torn down and it's all been planted over with corn. And we had parked, my partner and I had parked the car, and we were walking around and looking, and a fellow drove up in a big pickup truck, and he rolled the window, and he just said with concern in his voice, you know, are you in trouble?
Mm-hmm.
But he also, he talked, and it was clear, like, you know, if you're in trouble, I'm here to help you. But if you're here to cause trouble, I'm here to help you off the land.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
and he had that nuance in his voice. Mm-hmm. And as we talked with him, he's the brother, you know, he's in his 70s, and he's the brother of the man who lives on the farm that's still occupied. It's not a farm anymore because it's just a little house in the country. All the land belongs to a different farmer. And he said, well, you know, I'm headed up to see my brother. They're raising their great-grandchildren.
Okay.
Their children and their grandchildren died from drug use. And now they have to raise their great-grandchildren.
Oh, my God.
And we had a connection.
Yeah.
On that gravel road in the dust.
Yep.
That was just incredible.
Yes.
They had hoped to to run a sawmill. They made beautiful wood. They sold the sawmill to other people. We went into town and saw where the sawmill got moved to, and okay. and actually bought some furniture there. But they wanted to do that, but they're raising in their 70s, they're raising their great-grandchildren.
Yeah. Amazing.
So So that was a change, and he was willing to talk about it. That's and right. I think it's because, you know, are you in trouble? And nope, we're not in trouble. You know, we haven't lived here for 41 years, but my family owned this land for 75 years. Yeah. And, you know, we're just back.
I love that. I mean, those kind of things are completely beautiful to me. And they happen all the time if you are open to them happening. If you take a second to engage with somebody, right? As opposed to rolling up your window and going, no, we don't need any help, right? Which some people would do.
Right.
If you open up, if you open up the space for it to happen, there are great things that can happen from that. Great human things, you know.
It's to me, I was genuinely curious about this person.
Yes.
And he was genuinely curious about us.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I love that.
We were driving a rental car with Florida plates in Northwest Missouri. So, you know, we didn't fit.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I had the same encounter, a similar kind of encounter with the guy who told me that they, when we went camping in the middle of the night, we found the campsites and he had a Confederate flag. And he was looking at me with disdain. And I knew that would happen because I spoke to him on the phone and he sounded lovely. And when I was on, I called my friend Patricia, who's also a Black woman. And I said, trust me, he has no idea that I'm Black. Because he has in his mind that I have to speak a certain way because I'm Black. So I said, so let's see how lovely he is when I get there. You know, like,
right. So and you arrived in the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And he was like, he had this look on his face like, you know, like I pulled the trick or pulled the wool over his eyes or something.
Right.
And he goes, you know, I'm just going to tell you, we have a Confederate flag here. And I said, why? And he said, because I just feel like those boys fought in the war and they need to have some representation. And I said, well, thanks for telling me that. You have a great piece of land out here. I'm glad we found it. And that was that. And in the morning, he was pleasant.
Right. Right.
And those things to me are just like, they're not earth shattering. No. But that same exact moment had the potential to go in a completely different direction. And that's what I love, that you can switch the tracks on certain things. And I love that, to be able to do that.
Right, right. And I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate here. Mm-hmm. In that my guess is that your Black friends are going to see you as of going above and beyond what's really required of you, mm-hmm. or maybe that you should even bother.
Oh yeah.
But for me, I think the language about what are we expected to do, what are we required to do, doesn't help in this situation, because if we have the capacity to invite a change and we don't use it, it's on us. We will never know whether they had the capacity to change mm-hmm. if we don't try it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And yes, and not only my Black friends thought I was crazy, my white friends thought I was crazy.
Right.
And they all had all these suggestions, like, you should have done this. But they also coming out of this frame of mind that we always have to be in battle. I don't come from that frame of mind. I will engage in the battle if I feel it's necessary, but people respond in fighting and arguing and putting people down and telling them what they should not have done. I could have done that. It's just not, it's not in my bag of tricks.
Well, so it also doesn't invite connection.
Of course not.
The minute you enter something defensively or aggressively, you have ended the opportunity for an easy connection.
That's exactly what I know. That's why I don't use that kind of strategy. Also, it does exactly it would do exactly in those situations with being in known racist areas, mm-hmm. dealing with the Confederate flag. What it also does is it actually would, if I stood there and got angry and fought with him and told him why you shouldn't be having, why you shouldn't have a Confederate flag, what it does is not only shut down any kind of communication, but it affirms his racism.
Right.
Because he has a set of things that he bases that racism on, and it would affirm it. And that's not what I do. I just don't do that. I'm hoping for something different.
Right. So what you are saying is that if you don't give another person the chance to react to the stereotype that they've hold you in, then you're not likely to reproduce that stereotype.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you have to consciously choose to, one, identify the stereotype that they hold, and to not engender it or not act out of its mm-hmm. assumptions, but rather mm-hmm. act out of a possible relationship that doesn't recognize the stereotype in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's aware of it, but it doesn't honor it.
Exactly. Because the truth of the matter is, I could write up a whole stereotype about that particular kind of person.
Right. No, I know.
Right. Yes.
That's we have the all these things, scripts running in our
right?
head.
Exactly. Right. That's yeah. the reality. But that's not useful to what I'm trying to accomplish. So I don't use it.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Hugo, you're looking mighty pensive, and it's also time to cut to music, but I want to hear what's on your mind, and I also want to take a break from music, and we'll see what we come up with, and I'll drop it in here when we do, if you don't have anything to suggest right now.
Let's hear the music.
On the sands of time, no, there was something that meant something that I left behind. When I leave this world, I'll leave no regrets, leave something to remember so they won't forget I was here. So everyone will know I was here.
So we're talking about change, how to invite it, how to engage it, how to suffer it, how to imagine it more than anything, in a way that doesn't peg it as either, you know, it has to be good because it's the only way we could suffer through so much, or it's terrible and we'll never recover from it.
Exactly.
Which is kind of, you know, a lot of modernity, a lot of our consumer economy was sold to us on how much better it would be than the past. And it's ended up destroying the environment. And with, even without the oil, even without the carbon consumption, it destroyed the environment. Mm-hmm. But we haven't really talked about how we walk ourselves into a really hard place of our own choosing. We've kind of danced around that a little bit. Maybe that's not a fair statement. But
no, give me an example.
So early on in life, I kind of discovered that I tend to learn the most from people who are the least like me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would oftentimes try to find a professor or a mentor or somebody who I didn't understand, and they didn't make sense to me. And I had some even deep reservations about, you know, ethics or whatever. But I felt like in the world of being a human being, I both owe it to them to treat them as a human being and to learn from them, because that's where I am likely to learn the most. Now, in retrospect, I had to change my doctoral dissertation chair after 6 years into the program, which is not a good thing to do.
Yeah.
But it was necessary, and it should have been done within year one or two. But I didn't understand. I didn't understand the problem. So, for some people, it's, you know, getting the house and the kids and then discovering that's not where the, you know, it's not about having a house in a neighborhood. It's not about having a degree or having a career or having children. There's something that's just not quite right. And getting those things that you worked for, it doesn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
So when we choose to try to embrace change and it bites us,
mm-hmm.
how do we deal with that?
Mm-hmm. You know, for me, it's the same strategy of, you know, you decide, you know, even if it's like something you purchased that somebody told you was great and it wasn't great or whatever. But the same strategy for me applies, which is to say, what do I do with this now that it doesn't allow me to get stuck in the resentment, stuck mm-hmm. in putting myself down for even making the mistake in the first mm-hmm. place, hating that person, right, who gave me that bad advice, whatever it is. What do I do with this emotion, that this specific emotion that was ignited from that change that mm-hmm. I walked into voluntarily, that did not necessarily work out? And the same strategy applies. Okay, what do I do with this now?
Right.
How can I turn this into a moment where I can gain some wisdom from it? Because there's always wisdom to be gained for me or to me. And that is exactly where I go. Like I'm the sort of person that if I see a problem or foresee a problem, I am immediately in solution mode. I do
right.
not sit in the problem. I do not go, oh my God, I can't believe that happened. My mind goes immediately to how can I solve this problem?
Right. But it means you've recognized a problem.
Oh yes.
And for the examples that I have,
ah, yes.
For the examples that I have, a person with great wisdom told me, you need to divorce. There is no future in that marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I did not believe that person because I did not understand the scope of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I pursued on and became embittered in something that I was not able to make different,
mm-hmm.
that I had been told I would not be able to make different. But I also damaged myself in that process,
mm-hmm.
and the other person.
Mm-hmm.
The other situation was with that chair.
Yes.
Where I was told a couple of years in, you need to mm-hmm. move on.
Yeah.
Because this is in my head that I knew it wasn't working, but I didn't believe that it couldn't work out. You see what I'm saying?
I sure do, yeah.
I believed that by applying more hard work and more effort, somehow a compromise would be found, mm-hmm. or it would all work out.
Interesting, yeah.
You see what I'm saying? And I think that's...
Just like,
go ahead.
Yeah. Just like a bad marriage. I mean, you think you can fix it.
Yeah.
You know, if I just stay with it, I will be able to help that other person come through, you know?
Yeah.
And so what you're just saying that back to me, what I couldn't say is I need to sit with the fact that I can't fix it.
Yes. Right. Yes.
And not yeah. leave it, not leave yeah. it. I That's just right. need to sit with the fact that I can't fix it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Whether it's the doctoral committee chair or the marriage, and just let that awareness soak in.
Mm-hmm.
If you're prone to be an action-oriented person who solves problems, that's hard advice to take. Because I haven't recognized the severity of the problem. And I think I'm going into solution mode, mm-hmm. but it's an effort to solve a relational problem that is not solvable.
I wonder if, because it, as you say, like an action-oriented person who wants to solve problems, I could probably take on a lot of that kind of identity. But the difference is that I don't ever necessarily believe I could fix everything. Mm-hmm. And I am very willing to throw my hands up
right.
and go, that's somebody else's department.
Right. And I believed if I worked hard enough, I
right.
could.
Right.
And that's that I think is the profound difference.
Yeah. 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 And I wonder if, you know, I don't know.
I don't believe that now, but I did then.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if it's good or bad, but I wonder if part of it is about how much control we need or control or power we think we have or mm-hmm. or even just an illusion that everything can be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even come close to that illusion.
Right.
Nor do I, and so I don't invest, and I do try, like I've had several relationships that have fallen apart that I went back in and go, let's see if we can do something about this. And mm-hmm. and I love doing that. And I'm never hesitant to do that, whether it's about race or whatever it is. But I already know that if it doesn't work, I'm going to sit with that and then go, okay, what else can I do that's wonderful in this world, or, you know, where I can embrace somebody else in this world.
Right. I think for me, it involves saying, I don't want to cause more pain here.
Mm, interesting. Yes.
And I have, and there's no good thing that I can see coming from this.
That's right.
And that allows me to stop and to walk
yes.
away.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
You know, I come from, you just try harder.
Yeah.
But there's a point where you realize that this is not a matter of how hard you try. There's just something not working here. Or you're
exactly.
not partnered in the trying.
That's
and if
exactly.
you're not partnered in a way that is mutual, mm-hmm. then the change is not going to happen.
That mm-hmm. is exactly right. That's right.
And it's for both parties. And for people to stick together in that situation, both sides have to be committed to the fakeness of the dance.
Mm-hmm. And there are sort of split decisions to be made, because there is pain that comes out of trying too hard.
Right.
And there is pain that comes out of not trying.
Right.
And so we have to walk that very delicate balance and make decisions, decisions that constantly change based on that. If the goal is like, I don't want to cause any more pain. So at what point is trying too hard causing the pain, or trying too little causing the pain?
Right. And just sitting with, I can't fix it.
Oh, yeah.
Allows you to just sit in that space and discern.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I am very comfortable lovingly turning things over, whether it's to God or somebody else. It's above my pay grade. It's not my department. I'm just very comfortable going, I love you.
You consult your pillow.
The best for you.
Right.
It might take another human being.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And to the list of things that you just said, it's where you started with the dreams.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You can turn it back into that space to see what comes of it. And if you are relaxed in your life, you can go to your dreams and learn from them.
Yeah.
If you are pushing your life, you're not going to do that.
Yes. Hugo, you were going to say something. What were you going to say?
If you broaden the scope from a marriage into a broader universe of relationships, then I would say that I was the opposite of you. Okay. I was Mr. Fix-It for everyone until I hit the wall that made me realize that I could only fix myself.
Yeah.
And I think fixing everybody else, solving everybody else's problems, you know, was just a way of avoiding that self-examination that is required to pull back and watch people on their own path, knowing that's their path. And there's no way that I have any useful purpose other than holding on to compassion for them, you know? So that's a lesson, again, that came very late for me, that I had to pull back and watch a lot of tragedy in lives that I knew and with people that I love. And there was nothing I was going to be able to do that would make a difference, because they had to find it themselves, in themselves.
Yeah.
Hugo, it's very interesting to hear you say that. For me, if I identify the person as an other, I have a great deal of space for the suffering, the joy, the meandering, the process, that, and I don't own other people's stuff. When I feel that there is an hour there, that we own it together, then I'm not so clear. And in that space, in order for change to happen, what I've learned is, while we can delight and have an open-ended commitment to each other, we don't own it together. We own it separately. And we are together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a subtly different way of being. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another part of it, because there are some people, no matter how ugly the thing is that's coming because of some certain kinds of change, they still have not found the determination to let go of it, right? To change so that it doesn't happen. So when people are stuck in not deciding whether they even want the change, that's when you really can't do anything.
Right.
Once they decide that they want the change, then you can be helpful to them. And so if I'm going to be helpful to somebody, and I do believe that we can each be mentors and guides to one another,
mm-hmm.
and that's part of how I do my work, but I have to know what you want.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who try to fix things based on what they want for you.
Or that's what they perceive.
That is
that
exactly
you want.
Right. That, mm-hmm. Oh, that's right, what they perceive right. that you want.
Right, so and
yeah, go ahead, hon.
But
so I have to be clear, and it works the same way at UU. If you tell me that this is what you want, then I can help you get there. That's just
that's
reality.
That's why I think pulling back to be compassionately present,
yes,
usually opens a window yes. that comes from them, not from you.
That's right.
You know, and anything other than that is an inflated ego saying, I'm going to fix it,
exactly.
You know, and you're not.
No. And sometimes, like Eric was used the language of, sometimes you have to sit, hold it, and wait.
Right.
And not just jump in and go, okay, I know exactly what to do for you. We're going to yeah. do this.
Right. And but you also, you're using a word, and I want to unpack it here. It's really important for me to be listening really closely. And I'm not just talking with my ears. I'm talking with my eyes and with
Absolutely.
My hands and every part of my body so that I know when this person, what this person is talking about is what they want in their bowels, in their guts,
yeah.
in their heart, in their mind, in every part of their being. This is what they want. As opposed to this is what they would like to have.
Exactly.
And so yes. much of our relational space is kind of, oh, it would be good if it might.
Yeah.
It be,
yes.
You know, and that doesn't get us anywhere. And it's actually fairly useless conversation.
I agree.
And it's a waste of airtime.
Yeah.
To really visit about what matters.
Yeah.
We're here I am. I can do no other.
Yeah.
Hugo McAlier, Peaches Gillette. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think I want to close this with a song from an album called The Changer and the Changed by Chris Williamson. And it's called Waterfall. It's about filling up and spilling over
nice.
Like an endless waterfall. And that is the change.
Very nice. That's nice. So
thank
this
you
is
all.
The Native Clay Report. If you want to join us, you are welcome to come in and have conversation with us.
So Native Clay Report, you can reach us by leaving a phone message at the radio station at WRFI at 607-319-5445 extension 6. Or send a message to info@nativeclay.org if you have suggestions for topics. We would love to hear them. If you are willing to sit with us for the topic, we will bring you in as we brought Hugo in today. And we welcome the other voices. We can handle probably 3 people besides us at any given time. More than that gets to be a little wacky. But we can also just have a visitor for a half an hour or an hour if that fits your schedule. Again, 607-319-5445, extension 6. Or info@nativeclay.org. Thank you, Peaches. Thank you, Hugo.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Sometimes it takes a rainy day just to let you know everything's gonna be all right.
Like the